Well, wasn't that panel discussion just awesome? And I can't wait to go back and look at the video on that. And I really appreciate that Bobby Fry has been up there the whole weekend and got here a couple hours early yesterday. He's been working. And hi, Bobby. And he's filming right now. But I appreciate all of his hard work as well behind the scenes. And give him a round of applause. Yeah. One of the unsung heroes here at River Chase. We're going to talk about a tough topic. Saved a tough one for last. And the elders here, when I, of course, had several different types, categories of topics that we could have done this weekend, but wanted us to focus on this one, on how to affair-proof your marriage. And it's a difficult one to talk about because oftentimes, you know, I know when I'm speaking at, in different churches or different organizations that there very well might be folks under the sound of my voice that have gone through an affair. Maybe this is a second marriage because of an affair, or maybe there was an affair, either emotional or sexual or both, that took place with the couple, and you've moved on beyond that and have been able to put things back together. And so as we start, I would like us to remember something. Remember that God wants us, God seeks for us to have joy and satisfaction in our marriages. That's what God wants. He wants us to have that happiness and that joy. And therefore, I believe God seeks to protect us and protect the institution of marriage in general, but our individual marriages specifically. A number of years ago, I was working with a couple in counseling, and they've given me the okay to use this illustration. They're still together now. The husband had struggled with several affairs, also substance abuse. And as time went on, of course, there was a great burden upon that marriage. And they finally came to me. The straw that broke the camel's back for this couple was that he had had an affair with his wife's grown niece. All right? So just try to wrap your mind around that one. Of course, she was grown in her 20s. He was in his late 30s, early 40s at the time. That was just about it for that marriage. And they came in, and there was so much anger and vitriol, and rightfully so. On the anger part, I got it. I understood. But they were determined to try and make the relationship work and to get through it. Finally, she and he, we had these conversations about how much information should she know about the affair. And she really wanted to know everything so that there would be no surprises. Now, there's different philosophies about this in the counseling field. I'm of the persuasion that full disclosure, that's what I'm of the persuasion, so that there's no surprises down the road that things come up. And so one evening, she asked him, and we had talked about this, he sat down and he wrote down everything he could remember about the affair with the niece. Details, everything he could remember. She took it and she carried that document with her. She read it. She carried it with her for about 3 months in her purse, taking it out periodically, reading it, getting angry all over again, putting it back, taking it out, reading, and the cycle repeated. During that time, we were doing therapy together. Finally, she came in. They came in for one of our last sessions together, and she said, I feel free. I said, well, tell me, what do you mean you feel free? She said, this last week, it dawned on her that her husband was not totally to blame for the affair. There were some ways that she had contributed, in essence, maybe enabling behavior, maybe I'm not showing enough attention to him, or not that it excused the behavior. We've got to own our behavior, but she owned her behavior. She said, this week I took those sheets out. There's about 8 or 9 sheets that he had written. I read through it, and then I went in the backyard, and I found had this little metal container. And she said, I took it, and I wanted to burn it. So I lit it, and she kind of expected it, she said, just to kind of go up in flames. But she said, as she lit it, the papers just kind of smoldered there in the container, just like the anger and the resentment and bitterness had been smoldering inside of her. But once it smoldered out, she felt like she could release it. And I'm happy to say the couple stayed together. Since then, they've adopted a child. And it's been tough, and it's still hard at times. But if you are someone that has gone through that, I get it. And I'm glad you're here, though. And I understand that some of these things might be painful that we speak about. But I appreciate your willingness to stick to your marriage and to your vows. Exodus 20, verse 14, one of the Ten Commandments, you shall not commit adultery. You shall not commit adultery. It's a breach of covenant. It's a breach of trust. It destroys and can destroy families. It can destroy children. It hurts people. Every one of the Ten Commandments under the Old Testament was there to protect people from our own stupid selves, so that we can have, that they could have a life that was a covenantal life, a holy life, and a full life. Of course, we live under the New Testament. Jesus spoke much about this topic. But infidelity in our nation is on the rise, and we hear about it more and more every day, especially from celebrities. And extramarital sex, that's outside of marriage, is glamorized by movies and television. Did you know that if you're watching a movie or television show, that 90%, upwards of 90% of the sexual activities that we see in movies that are portrayed as such are outside the bonds of holy matrimony? So that's what we get a steady diet of. That's what our children at times are getting a diet of. And fidelity is out, and affairs are in, according to the society, the secular society in which we live, this godless world. It's no longer called adultery. How often do you hear the term adultery? People speak about it's an affair. It kind of softens it somehow. But we know what an affair is. In Proverbs 5 and verse 15 following, it says this, drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving deer, a graceful doe, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? For a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. The iniquities of the wicked ensnare him, and he is held fast in the cords of his sin. He dies for lack of discipline, and because of his great folly, he is led astray. Powerful words. A lot of images come to mind when we think about drinking water from our own cistern, all right? Keeping the love, keeping the sexual component within the parameters of marriage. In Proverbs 6, 27 through 29, then 32 to 33, can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Or can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. None who touches her will go unpunished. He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. He will get wounds and dishonor, and his disgrace will not be wiped away. It goes on. There are consequences to adultery. There are punishments and struggles and pain and suffering that comes not only to the spouse, the innocent spouse, but to the one who has perpetrated this crime against their relationship and this breach of their covenant. Country singer Gene Watson croons this. He says, "Slip into something soft, and then come slip into my arms again. Strip away your conscience and take off your wedding band." That sounds like our world, does it not? Cheating has become a national pastime. Statistically, 55 to 65% of men have affairs by the age of 40. Did you know that? 55 to 65% of married men have affairs by the age of 40. For women, it's about 35% that have affairs. Peter warns us to be sober-minded, to be watchful, because our adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. A certain minister out there who had forfeited his ministry due to sexual misconduct, and that happens a lot in the ministry, unfortunately, he stated this. He said, "I never thought it could happen to me, but it did. For 15 minutes of rolling in the sheets, I sacrificed everything precious in my life. Wife, children, reputation, ministry, even my health." Another person confided to a ministry colleague after committing adultery. He said this, "It just happened. It just happened." The minister replied, "No, it didn't just happen. You let it happen. For in every affair, there's a choice. For every affair, there are steps taken. There are roadblocks that are crashed through, and there are red lights that are run." I would like us for a moment, just as we're thinking about ways to shore up a marriage, to kind of put a protection around it to keep it from being as susceptible to an affair taking place. There's some five things that that men want in a wife. Syracuse University has spent a considerable amount of time researching marriage. And interestingly, of the 10 most important things a couple say for a relationship, of what they want in marriage, sex only comes in ninth, all right? Sex is not at the top of the list overall. It comes in about ninth. Caring, a sense of humor, and communication are at the top. And among men, the top five things that they say they want in a wife are as follows. Respect. Go figure that Paul wrote about that in Ephesians 5. Respect. So she makes me feel capable. She's proud of me. She's willing to follow me when I lead. Domestic support. A home that's a refuge from the stress of the world. A home that's fun, pleasant. A home that's tastefully appointed. Third, companionship. She responds to me. She studies what is mutually pleasing. Gets good at it. She makes time for me. She takes our sexual relationship seriously. That's where I should have been. And five is an attractive wife. She's clean. She does her hair. She cares about how she looks. She stays in the best shape that she can. Naturally, all those values come in and out of focus. And I want you to keep in mind that what's beautiful to one person may not be to another. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But the main thing is that your spouse finds you attractive, women, and that you do what you need to do to be the best you, physically, that you can be, as well as in other ways. What about the top five things women want in a husband? So, here they are. Number one is affection. Affection. The first thing that Genesis chapter 1 and 2 says God didn't make out of dirt is woman. Made woman out of the man's rib side by side. And Ephesians 5:25 explains that wives ought to be loved and wives ought to be cherished. This means romance. This means a steady stream of hugs and pats or, maybe some don't like pats on the back, but hugs and compliments and kisses and kindnesses. William Jennings Bryan, some of you might know who that is, but he always wore his hair over his ears. And somebody once asked him, because this was past the time that it was in that day fashionable to have your hair over your ears. They said, why was it that he did this? Why did he have this hairstyle? And his response was that when he was courting his wife, she thought that his ears stuck out and they looked funny. And so she wanted him to grow his hair over his ears. So he did. And to which the pal replied, but that was years ago. That was years ago. And why do you still have your hair over your ears now? And Brian responded, he said, sure, but the romance is still going on. And so he was willing to show, I guess, affectional consideration to his wife by doing what she found helpful and attractive. Women want conversation on a feeling level. She wants to talk about her emotions. She wants to have him share about the feelings inside of his heart. Honesty and openness. A man who won't close the door on me. A man who will be transparent about his life and his yearnings and his experiences. Financial support. A husband needs to provide for the needs of his family to the best of his ability. In fact, Paul would write that a man that does not take care of his family is worse than an infidel who is denied the faith. That's a responsibility we have from God. And I know many of us have shared incomes, but husbands especially have that responsibility. Family commitment. If you treat your wife like a queen, you'll get to be the king, men. If you treat your wife like a queen, you get to be the king. This is paraphrased up in the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Matthew 7, verse 12. So we're going to take a few moments to take a look at a famous couple and look at the anatomy of their affair. How it happened between David and Bathsheba. And there were several steps. It didn't just happen. There's some background to how this came about. And I think as we think on this, we can see ways that we can raise our antennas and just be more aware and more cognizant and more careful about some of these issues found from 2 Samuel 11 and 12. The point of this, by the way, is that an affair is easy. An affair is easy to get into. First of all, is estrangement. David and his wife, Michelle, are on the outs. David's excited about bringing the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem. And first time was a flop, and you remember how Uzzah touched the Ark and got struck dead, right, for trying to stop it on the threshing floor as the Ark was rolling off the cart. So David goes back to the drawing board, back to the Torah, figures out how to do this, and they come in, and the Levites are carrying it properly on the poles, and they come into Jerusalem, and David is jubilant. He is excited, and he is dancing in the streets in nothing but his tunic. He is just on fire for God. Michelle, the daughter of Saul, you might remember, she belittles David. She says, "My, how the king has lowered himself before the people today, dancing half naked like a vulgar fellow." 2 Samuel 6, verse 20. From that day on, David and Michelle barely speak. You know what? Her name never comes up again in the Bible after that experience. It's gone. Something turned off in David. She humiliated David. She did not show that respect and that admiration. And think about how most marriages don't fail because out of a big blow up. It's typically a slow leak. And it takes time, and there's gradual things. There were probably other things. This was probably just the hem of the garment. I imagine Michelle was in the habit of kind of looking down her royal nose at David, the shepherd boy who now had supplanted her father, Saul, as king. And so a poet once wrote this. They said, "'Twas not love's going that hurt my days, but that it went in little ways." So the flame flickers dim, sex becomes routine. She can't remember a tender time. He can't remember when she really showed support, and they quit trying together. And before you know it, the marriage is estranged. Encounter. So David and Michelle are estranged, and next in the anatomy of the affair comes the encounter. In 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 5, it says this. In the spring of the year, the time when the kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from his roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." David is middle-aged by this point. His days in the battlefield are kind of gone. Notice when the kings normally go out to battle, he doesn't go. He stays back in Jerusalem this time. He's got lots of time on his hands, wondering what's going on the battlefield and time to entertain himself. And maybe his self-esteem has gone down a little bit. He's not quite the warrior he once was. His relationship with Michelle is all but non-existent. And so David is susceptible. He's maybe going through a midlife crisis. Some experts believe that a hormonal lack, a man has a hormonal lack only his wife can provide with respect. And similarly, women have a hormonal lack that only her husband can provide with cherishing. The spouse isn't provided, a hunger sets in, and a hunger was setting in for David. Next is empathy. Estrangement, encounter, empathy. Look at the action verbs back in 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 5. Samuel saw her. He sent for her. David inquired about her. He's trying to get something going, something in his mind, maybe a fantasy that's going. He's acting upon it. And think about a woman in those days. Women were sheltered. They didn't go out in public, typically, unescorted by, with no chaperone. And if they went out, then their hair would be up. They would be veiled, right? Very careful in the way that they presented themselves. But nowadays, women are in the workforce. Women let their hair down, don't they? Women dress to show off their figures. Men do too, sometimes. Encounters are much easier. You've got two starving people they meet, and they sparks kind of fly at the workplace or at a work conference they're at. The whiff of the perfume and the swishing back of the hair or the flexing of the muscles. And a woman or a man's interest is stirred. If the sparks land in dry lives, the flame is quickly kindled. Sometimes people meet on the web. They meet an old friend, a woman from high school or college, or somebody new in a chat site, even Facebook, and they start messaging each other, maybe then texting each other, then maybe phone calling each other, maybe sending photographs of each other, clothed, and then maybe some with partially unclothed, and then maybe totally unclothed to each other. Before long, they are setting a date and a time to meet up. Enjoyment. David saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. 2 Samuel 11:2. He liked what he saw. He wanted more. He was voyeuristic. He was turned on by what he saw. The deceptive sweetness of forbidden fruit. David, think he knew better? Of course he knew better. He was a man after God's own heart. He knew better. But like a moth drawn to a flame, we fly closer. I'll just carry her bags up to the hotel room. That's all. Maybe I'll just stay 10 minutes and then I'll leave. Maybe we can go out just for a drink or go out for a meal. It'll be harmless. We don't have to tell our spouses. It's just business. Maybe I want to text her a little joke. Maybe I just want to check in on, see how she's doing today. We've got this inside joke that we shared. Maybe I want to share, feed that inside joke because it was funny when it happened. And you see how this relationship and this enjoyment is building. And now we begin to live in a fantasy world and we wonder how it would be. We undress them in our minds. Our thoughts are ripe with the pleasures of them. And Jesus states in Matthew 5:28, "But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery in his heart." Romans 13:14 warns, "Make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires." This is a roadblock, and we just brazenly go through the roadblock. Expedite is next. David actually sent for Bathsheba, verse 4 of chapter 11. She comes to his palace. It was like granting Satan an easement across his property. We decide to go to a weekend conference together. She happens to be there too. Actually, we knew that she knows that he was going to be there. And we arranged to stay in the same hotel, just so we can be close for convenience. Go out to dinner again, maybe share some drinks, or we decide to ask her to work late at the office. I'll just drive her home. Well, I'll just drive him home. Bolder and bolder we become. "You have nice shoulders. My shoulders are kind of tense. Do you mind giving me a shoulder massage?" "Sure. I'll be happy to." Expediting. Next, expression. The text says, "So David took her and he lay with her." He stepped over the line. His thoughts became action. His fantasy turned into sex. Now the two adulterers become obsessed. They're totally addicted. Now, by the way, Bathsheba, she's not totally innocent in this, right? She played along with it. Though David certainly had some kingly power that he was wielding, misusing. And so they often lose their sense of judgment. And suddenly, "You're a fool," as they say, as the Proverbs writer says. Because adultery is not purely a sexual sin. It's at the root of the inability to handle romantic feelings of romance towards someone who was never meant to meet those needs. The problem is not between two people. The problem is in two people. And so we've got to do some soul searching and working on our heart, working on our faith, and then finally you got the effects. The affair is not over with the sexual experience because it leads to more. David formed an elaborate scheme. Now she's pregnant. Now he has to do something about this. abortion is out. He feels like he loves Bathsheba, though it's limerence, it's this fantasy he's in. So he conjures up the scheme. How can we handle this? So he tries to get Uriah to come off the battlefield, her husband. Because he wants Uriah to come off the battlefield and have intercourse with Bathsheba. So that when she has a child, it was Uriah's. But David didn't know Uriah. Uriah comes off the battlefield, gives a report to King David. David says, why don't you go back to your house tonight? Go be with your wife. Not Uriah. All the other men are on the battlefield. Uriah says, no, I'm not going to go home to my wife. I can't do that when I know but my fellow soldiers are out there risking life and limb. I'm going to sleep up here by the courts, by the palace. I'm not going to go to my house. So David's plan is foiled. Uriah goes back to battle. Next, David goes, okay, we've got to do something about Uriah. If I couldn't get him to sleep with his wife, I'm going to have to get him killed. I'm going to have to get him murdered, right? So he sends message. He sends the word to those out there on the battlefield. And basically, he says, look, put your Uriah up in the front of the battle, Joab. Put him in the front. And then when he's in the front, when he's in the heat of the battle, withdraw from him. Set him up. And so that's what they do. And Uriah dies. Okay? Now, let's go on with the effects. So that's the first effect. This is how God judged, because God knew. David and Bathsheba's child died. Remember that? She died. Nathan the prophet said to David, because you have utterly spurned the Lord, the sword will not depart from out of your house. David's daughter Tamar was raped by her brother. Another effect. His son Amnon was murdered. His boy Absalom rebelled and was slain. His next in line to the throne, Adonijah, is killed. Solomon goes on and marries over 1,000 wives that draw his heart away from Yahweh, away from Jehovah God. My, 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 what an awful legacy David left for his family. A man utterly broken from the effects of adultery once moaned this. He said, if I had only known how far down it would take me, how long it would hold me, how deeply it would hurt me, I would never have done it. Adultery is like that. It's like a rat nibbling the cheese in a trap. The food is great. It's a forbidden fruit. But the consequences are deadly. So how do we know when you've crossed the line? Talking emotionally. How do you know if you've crossed the line between friendship and something more? There are three signs. Number one, emotional intimacy. You start sharing some things with that other person that you don't share with your own spouse. You start getting into secret parts of your life and things that are very near and dear. You start dreaming with this other person that's not your spouse. You draw close. You have this emotional connection to them. There's sexual tension. We've got built into our bodies, our physiology, a visceral response, a chemical, neurochemical response. When we're attracted to somebody, when the sparks fly, we know it. We know it, all right? We can sense the sexual tension that's there. Got to be careful about ignoring that. Pay attention to it and put up your guard. Then secrecy. Secrecy. We stop letting our spouse know about our interactions. Every time that the spouse walks by, we close down our email window, or we turn off our phone, or we erase our messages. If you see any of these signs, it's time to reevaluate your friendship with this other person. You're in the danger zone. Next, Never say never. Never say never, because an affair is easy. It begins with when we allow our marriages to grow stale, and one thing leads to another, and before you know it, we've fallen into it. In James 1, 14 through 16. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then desire, when it's conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. A number of years ago, we were in North Texas. I was preaching for the Henrietta Church. At one point, we had 5 kids in our household because we were doing foster care. We had a 2-, 3-, 4-, 5-, and 7-year-old. I just wanted to get out of there sometimes. It was crazy at home. Missy wanted to get out of there at times. It was nuts. I knew I was susceptible, though. We were so busy with the kids, it was really hard to focus on each other. At the time, actually, I think at least 2 of the kids weren't potty trained. So it was chaotic. So one evening after work, I worked late at the office working on some sort of project. I was hungry. They'd already eaten, so I decided to go to my favorite place, Subway, there in Henrietta, Texas. And it was about 9 o'clock at night, just before closing time, and I walk in, and I'm the only one in Subway. There's the lady making the sandwiches. So I chat with her a little bit, and as I'm talking, another woman walks in behind me. This woman is close to my age at the time, maybe a little bit older than what I was. I was in my mid-30s back then, early 30s, I guess, wearing a low-cut blouse. And I noticed she had a tattoo right here. It was a heart, a red heart tattoo. And she started flirting with me. Told me a little bit about, you know, she's got a couple of teenage daughters and evidently was not in a relationship. So we're talking in the line a little bit and I'm feeling a little queasy about it. Coming through the line, and my plan was to eat there in Subway, so I get my sandwich, and she's still in line. She's finishing her sandwich, getting her for herself. So I go sit down at a table by myself, open up my sandwich, say my prayer, and I'm just feeling something inside of me. And then I think for a moment, and I say, she's going to come and sit by me. I know it. She is going to come and ask if she can sit with me. What am I going to do? So as her back is turned and she's paying out, I wrap my sandwich up and I beeline out the door. She probably turned around and went, "Where did that guy go? It was a miracle." But I ran because I knew I was fixing to maybe be in trouble here and put myself in a dangerous situation with this woman. Here's some rules quickly to think about, rules to avoid temptation. Spend your recreational time either alone with your spouse or with same-sex friends. Watch out. Number 2, no meals alone with someone of the opposite sex, unless she's your mother or an aunt or a daughter. No rides in cars alone with those of the opposite sex, because that can lead to at least the appearance of evil. Number 4, never tell someone of the opposite sex that you find them attractive or that you like them unless they are your spouse. If someone of the opposite sex ever tells you that they find you attractive, start talking about how much you love your spouse. Number 6, cultivate same-sex friendships with persons who share your morals and your values. Remember on the panel a moment ago, one of the ladies shared about other women that didn't share some of the same values and was bashing husbands. Find a group of folks that you trust that have got your back and have got your God as well and are serving God with you. Run for your life. like Joseph did from Potiphar's wife in Genesis 39. These are practical ideas that I try to follow. Making your marriage affair-proof requires a large investment of time and emotional capital, but the investment is definitely worth it. Set high standards for yourself. Set high standards for your marriage. Be men and women of integrity. Be people of purity. I hope someday that's Missy and I walking down life's path hand in hand. There's a lot riding on this message today. I hope that something that I've said has been practical, maybe at least cause you to step back and think about yourself and your behavior, or maybe your propensities or things that tempt you. I once had a student at Frieda Hardeman in my family and individual counseling class that we were doing a thing on ethics, and I asked the class to write about what would happen if they, as a counselor or minister, were attracted to somebody of the opposite sex. How would they respond in a counseling situation? You know what he wrote down? This guy just got married a few months before. He said, "I would never be attracted to somebody of the opposite sex because I'm married." I wrote in red, "Wrong! You might be married, but you ain't dead." We've got to watch ourselves. We've got to keep ourselves close to God's heart. I appreciate so much this weekend and your kind attention being out on Sunday afternoon. And thank you for the support you've given to the conference. And thank you, elders. Thank you, ministers, for all that have gone into this, and all the wives and panel discussion. It's been a thorough joy. And I would like to just ask Dwayne last time. I'm going to ask Bill this time to come on up. And Bill, would you lead us in a closing prayer, please?
Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we are so grateful for your church, for your plan for us, for the relationship that we have with you and with all these brothers and sisters through your son, Jesus. Father, we're grateful for the last 2 days that we've had, for the teaching that we've heard from your word. We're thankful for Ryan and Missy, for their family, for the investment that they are making in other people, the ministries that they're involved with. And we pray your very rich blessings on them as they continue to help other people. Father, we pray that